It's good to be with you guys today. Today what we're doing is we're continuing in our current series on the letters that the Apostle Paul once wrote to the struggling Christian community in the city of Corinth. And if you've been here the last few weeks, there's been a pattern to the teaching so far that's worth drawing out to help us for the rest of the series. So over the 6 Sundays of this series, our plan is to alternate each week between explorations of who Paul is reminding us that God is, and then what it means for us to reflect these characteristics as Christians. So in the first week, we looked at 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 15, in which Paul insists to the Corinthian church that the essential heart of the gospel of Jesus is his death on the cross. He says, this is the thing. And he argues that if we don't make this the cornerstone, then we're going to miss the point. Because the cross is the actual wonder of God's whole plan for the world. And then last week, we looked in chapter 2 of 1 Corinthians to see what living a cross-shaped life might actually mean for us. And we learned last week that if we really understand the cross and how it has destroyed the power of sin over us, how it has united everybody who depends upon it in this holy embrace and this radical forgiveness of God, then the evidence of that understanding can and only be an end to division and disunity among us. To know that we've been wholly accepted despite all of our flaws should, Paul argues, lead us to wholly and unconditionally accept each other. This, Paul says, is the milk of Christian faith. It is the first and the most basic lesson. If you realize that you have been forgiven, then you ought to be somebody who forgives. This week, what we're going to do is we're going to build on that lesson by taking a closer look at what Paul suggests is the next discovery. If not the milk, then maybe the bananas and the pureed green beans or something of what we believe about God. And this is it. This is the bananas and green beans. It's that God is love. God is love. God is unimaginably and he is unreasonably forgiving, and he is love. He's the perfect expression of that word and that idea. More than that, his hand behind creation is why love exists at all for a thing to us to encounter or to feel. Love, I would like to propose today, is the essential note in the universe that brings all of our lives to vibrate in resonance with it. Because it is in love that we sense the stuff that really holds all of this together. Resonance is a musical idea, so in the event that you are not musically inclined, let me offer some other metaphors for you. Love is the salt that brings out all the other flavors in the recipe. Love is the feeling of rain on parched soil. Love is beauty. And when you see it, and when you know it, love is the deepest and the deepest truth. If this is beginning to sound like the sermon that a pastor might preach at a wedding, I get it. I've actually officiated a handful of weddings before. But I've never actually spoken about the letter to the Corinthians in those ceremonies for this reason. It feels too cheesy for a wedding. And it also feels a little too small. Because the love of a husband and a wife isn't the same as God's love. God's love is that love, the husband of a spouse. And it is also the love that their families feel toward them. It's the love that they might feel one day for a child. It's the love of the sunshine during the ceremony and the music and the cake that people stuff into each other's mouths. It's not just bigger than a wedding. It's everything. But we might ask this morning, what is love's nature? How do we describe or define not just this artwork that God has painted with his creation, but also this particular brush that he has used to do it? I don't know. But Paul gave it a try. Here's what he writes in 1 Corinthians 13. It's the whole chapter. If I speak in the tongues of humans and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. and if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable. It keeps no record of wrongs. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For now, we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now, we see only a reflection as in a mirror darkly. But then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love remain these three, and the greatest of these is love. Love, Paul says here, is behind every other thing. It is, he says, behind the expressions even of our spiritual gifts or the Holy Spirit-given abilities that grow in us as Christians as we learn to walk in our faith. And it is, Paul says, the very thing that gives those gifts meaning and purpose. It is what makes them resonate in the world that he has made, because it is the note that is underneath everything in the world that he has made. So Paul says in this passage that speaking in tongues, or if that's like a confusing phrase for you, let me rephrase it for you, that speaking in the raw feelings of your prayers, that is nothing if the note of love isn't underneath the things that you say. I, for one, can believe this. I pray a lot. I've not always been great prayers, and I've heard a lot of prayers, and they're also often very, oh boy, that sentence got away from me. They're not great. That's what I was getting at. I've heard prayers before that felt like they were really at their root judgments. You may have heard prayers like that too. God be with Sally as she strays from your path and bring her home. God show Jimmy the error of his ways. But if love isn't behind our words when we pray, and Paul's saying our prayers aren't of God. Paul says that prophecy, or again, if that word's uncomfortable, let me reframe it for you. Calling out the sins of a people or church or even a nation. The prophecy is useless if there's no hope for love and flourishing inside the things that you say. And this too resonates with me right now. Right now there's much to criticize in our world. But do we condemn the things that we condemn because they're bad policy or because they frighten us? Or we condemn them because they are out of alignment with the love of God for all things and all peoples. And hear me on this in particular. Is there still love behind your criticism? Is there hope that the resonance of love is always right there for anybody on any side of any issue who is willing to tune themselves back into it? Paul looks in this passage at other gifts too, right? He says that faith must trust completely in that loving nature of all things. He says that teaching must be anchored always in that truth of love. He says that generosity must be rooted in a recognition of what other people really deserve rather than your own self-righteousness. Love, Paul is trying to say, isn't one more thing among other things for those of us who have given ourselves over to Jesus. It is the thing for us as it was for him. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It was a version of this sermon where I just kind of went on like this, waxing poetic about love for another, I don't know, 12 to 15 minutes was kind of what I had in mind. But as I was writing verse 5, the one that I just read, stalled me out. Because I don't know that I've ever really noticed it before, or rather that when I have read it, when I have noticed it, I've reduced it in my mind to a kind of interpersonal instruction. One of those things we read and take as like wisdom for marriage or wisdom for my relationships, perhaps. But seeing the verse in that way has led me away from something really important that I think it has to say. So let's read this one part of it again. Love does not insist on its own way. Think about this. Think about what it means for this to be God's nature. Think about it, what it means for this to be a brushstroke that is in the actual making of all things. Think about it, in other words, as the way the world really is. Think about it, in other words, as truth. Love does not insist on its own way. Which means then that God does not insist on God's own way. Why not? If love is better, if God's ways are better, why doesn't he simply snap his fingers and make them so? There was a meme. I didn't know how to transition out of that challenge, and I just decided to go with a meme. There was a meme bouncing around last year that you might have seen at some point. And it involved an interview with the actresses Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande during the promotional tour for the movie Wicked. Are you familiar with Ariana Grande, Cynthia Erivo, and the film Wicked, Part 1? In this interview, the interviewer tells the two actresses that people have been, quote, holding space for the lyrics of the song Defying Gravity. And Erivo is clearly befuddled at this interviewer's choice of words. She has no idea what holding space for the lyrics of Defying Gravity might mean, but nonetheless, she is visibly moved by the turn of phrase. And then Ariana Grande, seeing Cynthia Erivo be so moved, does this weird thing that you may remember where she reaches out and just delicately pinches only one of Cynthia Erivo's fingers. Some of you did not see this meme. I have no idea why things go viral in the world that we live in and other things don't, but this did. This went really, really viral. It was everywhere for a couple of weeks. We could say, perhaps, that it resonated with people. But why? What was it about? The interviewer and the actresses were asked about this. Why did this thing that you did without knowing you were doing it turn into thing that people all care about? They were asked that kind of ridiculous question over and over again in the weeks and the months that followed. And eventually the interviewer pointed somebody back to a blog post she had read once upon a time by a woman named Heather Plett back in 2015. And in that blog post, Heather Plett said this. She said, the term holding space is about being willing to show up for another person or a group of people and to do so, especially when they're going through a challenging time, and do it with intention around not judging them, not trying to control them, not trying to change the outcome of whatever they're going through. It's about doing so in a way that they feel supported and loved and held compassionately. There is a certain modern American progressive sentiment here that might be music to your ears, or it might feel off-putting. But I want you to try and hear what Plett is trying to say. She's saying there is something good and true and healing about compassionate and patient presence with people. That this resonates. There's something divine in this, in holding space for others without judgment and without rushing to solutions. There is something of it, in other words, about love. Here's the thing, though, right? I'm a parent. I am also a son, and I'm also a friend. And I hear how nice all of this sounds, and I want to believe it. But I know what it feels like to be frustrated by people I care about making poor decisions. Maybe that's where you're at hearing all this. I know what it feels like to be panicked by the consequences of those decisions, the consequences those decisions can have and the speed at which those consequences can pile up for them. and that frustration and that panic about what might happen if a course isn't corrected, it sets this imaginary timer on my compassionate presence with people, I think. I will sit with you and I will wait for you, but eventually you do have to get up and act right. I think this is a really, really normal way for us to feel. I think it's a human way for us to feel. The question is it holy? Is it a holy way to feel? Last week, we looked at the scandal of the cross, and we asked ourselves, if God's way of solving things seems unreasonable to us, is that a problem for God, or is that a problem for our understanding of what is reasonable? And if that was like a milk lesson, or a moment when our sense of things needed to be turned completely upside down so that we could begin to understand God's sense of things as being better, as being more true and more right than our sense of things, then this week feels like peas and carrots. It feels like a next step in this process. What if bottomless patience is actually the real way of it all? What if the barrier to our trust, what if our discomfort with something like holding space is our own fear that God can't really do anything and everything that God wants? That there are some sins, that there are some consequences that are beyond his ability to fix? Is a fear like this, we ought to ask ourselves, is a fear like this really all that reasonable? Is it as reasonable as we think it is? If God is really God, we have to actually look at what he's done and trust that the things he's done aren't just a way to do things, that they are the way to do things. And what does God's love really look like? God doesn't insist on his way. That can feel uncomfortable, but it's true. He doesn't. He comes to us where we are. He sits with us compassionately, and he sits with us patiently, and he invites us over and over and over again to let him pick us up, to let him help us. Our hope, our salvation, our deliverance isn't mandatory. The problems, of course, are real. We live in a broken world that we are hell-bent on breaking further and further. And this breaking of things will hurt us, and it will hurt other people. It will keep doing that. Consequences are, in fact, real. But they are rarely, if ever, lightning bolts from God. Instead, our God waits, not at a distance from us, but right here with open arms. Because God is love, patient, kind, never envious, never boastful, never rude, not insisting on his own way, not irritable, keeping no record of wrongs, never rejoicing in evil, but delighting in truth, because truth is delight. He bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. His love never ends. The bottomless patience of God is waiting on us to see who he really is and understand how his creation really works. And we struggle desperately with trust, with focus, with believing this, but it is the deepest truth. God is love. Every moment of resonance and truth in our lives is a point of contact with God. And that's why every feeling of love matters. So if that's who God is, who then are we? In another letter to the Corinthians, Paul writes this: therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. On the contrary, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. If our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. Who are we? We are the servants of the world, which means we are the servants of the unbelieving and the sinful and the reckless and the seemingly hopeless. We're people who are persecuted for the seeming foolishness of a life lived in thrall to God's love. It won't appear to work. It will lead to hardship. It will be distrusted and rejected in the name of things that feel very important, like the efficacy or the expediency or the toughness of trying to straighten things out. And yet, this is who we are fundamentally. It is our root, this love, just as this love is the root of all creation. So what? I would contend today that to be Christians is to hold this note, to vibrate in resonance with God's love and broadcast it, to be people who understand that this is who and what God is, to do this without compromise or without losing heart. You are a space holder, if you prefer that turn of phrase. Somebody who shows up, sits without judgment, puts an arm over a shoulder, and waits to be embraced. You are ambassadors of God's love, feeling it and trusting it and modeling it for everybody else. And this work matters precisely because love like this, love that is selfless and sacrificial and patient, love that is true, is incredibly difficult to believe in this world. As we keep saying, it makes no sense. It appears unreasonable. Therefore, it must be lived out and tested and proven by real people in real relationships. You have to live this way so people will believe it is possible to live this way. It is not enough for you to just post about it. It's not enough for you to just put a yard sign up about it, about who you love and what love means to you. Those things are great. It's not enough. It's not enough for you just to wear it on a t-shirt, to say it with your mouth. It's not enough for you to belong to a church that says it for you in a sermon or with a headline or an article on its website. You must go out and live it. If you are a servant of Christ, you have to follow the example of Christ and go where people are. So there are two challenges for us today, my dear, dear friends. The first is this: go. Go. This week, today, talk to somebody who needs to feel loved, which is to say anyone on earth. Pause the things in your life that feel urgent to you, and if you like the phrase, hold space for a stranger. If you don't know any strangers, which is the look a lot of you are giving me, like, but I don't. That's an oxymoronic thing to say, isn't it? I don't know any strangers. Then make a plan to encounter somebody. There are ways you can do that through Revolution. There are ways you can just do that that you know about, right? You can serve at the food pantry here on Tuesdays. That'll introduce you to about 100 people every single week. You can volunteer at the Lighthouse Shelter. That'll introduce you to people that you don't already know. You can attend a meeting for your HOA. That will introduce you to people who need to feel loved. Some of you are like, don't preach like that. I've been with you for 25 minutes. That's too far. Go where people are and love them. One of the first things that I tried to do when I started at Revolution 9 years ago was create a rhythm for those of us who were on staff at the time. There are actually multiple people on staff once upon a time. Oh, that was a different way. I remember trying to start a rhythm for them where the goal was to spend one day a month using your workday to just walk around Annapolis without a plan. That was the idea. And so the idea was you would take $20. The Revolution would give you $20. And your only job was that you could not come back before 4 p.m. You had to go in the morning, couldn't come back to the office before 4, and you couldn't bring the $20 back with you. That was the rule. You could use it for whatever you wanted. You could support a local business. You could pay for some random family's ice cream. You could give it to somebody in Annapolis who had their hand out. It didn't matter. The point wasn't that that $20 was going to change our city or to change the world or even change a person's life. The point was that giving away $20 pressured us to connect with somebody. And maybe that's a practice that you can use too. What is the discipline you can put in place in your life that will pressure you to connect with somebody? Go. And the second challenge this morning is this: as you go, don't lose heart. Don't lose your nerve. Loving with no strings attached will make you vulnerable. That's the way it goes. And so many times, loving with no strings attached will feel foolish, stupid. Your patience with people is going to be abused. It's going to seem pointless, like nothing really happened, like it didn't get anywhere. The person didn't learn any lessons. And I've been here for days, weeks, months, years, and they haven't changed a bit. But here's the thing. This is the way of Jesus. And sooner or later, we are all going to have to choose whose wisdom are we going to trust, his or ours. The milk lesson to the Corinthians was to remember the cross. The next lesson builds on that lesson, because if the cross is our actual foundation, if dying is the thing we've already accepted, then what are we so worried we're going to lose by loving somebody? So be courageous. Love wildly and generously and patiently. And even if we're a little church, a church that lives like that could be beautiful. And if you live like that, living in harmony with the loving song of your God, that can be beautiful too.